Welcome to Intersection Live, the tax and accounting profession's premier podcast source. Provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting. The Intersection Live podcast series is brought to you by ADP Small Business Services, supporting the accountant community. This is Tech to Go, a monthly fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollette and regular columnists Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession.
This is Tech to Go, episode 19, Innovation. Good morning, Greg LaFollette. We're recording Tech to Go, episode number 19. We've got the whole gang here this morning. Good morning, Randy.
Good day, Greg.
Nice to have you. The illustrious Randy Johnston, leader of the technology world for those of us in public accounting. Our friend Brent Goodfellow out in the West Coast. Good morning, Brent.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. And as usual, Dave McClure bringing up the Eastern time zone. Good morning, David.
Well, good morning, Greg. Nice to be with you again.
Thanks to all of you for joining us. We've got a real full set of topics for today. So I want to start by, it's been a while since we were together out in Las Vegas for Tech Plus, and we did that one live. Dave, we missed you, but we suffered through without you. We made faces at one another. It was a fun time to, you know, to do our one time that we get to do Tech to Go live with everybody in the room, and it was a lot of fun. So subsequent to that, we went over to Los Angeles the following week and awarded the 5th annual Innovation Awards. This is awarded to five vendors in the tax and accounting technology area, innovation and technology in the tax and accounting world. And I want to kind of bounce through these and get you guys, as you were all judges, you all know who the winners were by now, because that press release all went out, and I know I sent everybody a note as soon as we announced them. You were all judges in this contest, and I appreciate your time. You know how thick that book was of nominees. There was an awful lot of work, and I appreciate your time going through it. I don't have any idea how any of you voted on these five. I'm not even sure I can remember exactly how I voted on these five, but I'm very happy with them, very, very proud of them. And I'd like to just kind of announce those and then get your opinions and your ideas on these things. The first is Copanion Inc. and their Gruntworks system. And this is a brand new system that basically does scan and organize. They have a product now that takes a whole stack of input pages for a 1040, and after it's scanned, organizes them and puts them together. And they were they certainly impressed a lot of people last year. SurePrep, one of their competitors, actually won an innovation award. These guys this year, Copanion, with their product, impressed the judges a lot, and I think part of it might be that their plan to actually do the scan and populate. This has been around for a while. Any thoughts or ideas on this one? Why you think the judges saw value in this one?
Well, you know, on that particular offering, Greg, there's a couple of things that they're doing that I don't believe anybody else is actually doing. They're doing a lot more pattern recognition as opposed to trying to do forms or OCR-based recognition. That's a key difference. Also, the infrastructure is designed in such a way as to be extremely scalable and extremely secure. I think that's probably another key issue. And if, in fact, they get this particular piece right, they can classify documents more rapidly based on an unknown document as opposed to having the having to have someone update the software to figure out what the document is, put in the classifications, and then begin recognizing it. This can actually be a self-learning software where it'll understand the patterns and say, oh, this must be another one of these, and here's how we're going to recognize it. And then a future document of that same type, it can recognize very, very fast. So self-learning might be the third item.
Okay. Certainly makes sense. Brent, have you looked at these guys?
Yeah, and Randy's talking about the technical stuff. I watched my tax partner look at both 1040 Scan and the Gruntworks product, and to him, it was all in the pricing model.
Uh-huh.
You know, 1040 Scan has this model where you have to buy a chunk of returns, and if you don't use, you know, the number of returns you buy, you just lose them. And Companion is, you know, kind of the same model, except they're significantly less expensive, and it just made more sense. You know, that's just another viewpoint.
Yep. You know, and I really think you can have innovation in pricing. And a couple of years ago, Microsoft Office won an innovation award, actually 2 years in a row, for Office Accounting, and the second year was very clear that they won it based on their pricing model of free.
Yep.
So, you know, that was certainly there. David, were you impressed with these guys when you voted?
I was, and Greg, it's interesting that very often when we look at these, we tend to think of innovation as being something absolutely brand new and earth-shattering, whereas I tend to look, as you know, we've been doing these for a few years now, I tend to look also at incremental innovation. Are they taking a category that's well-known where the features are fairly standardized at this point, but are they really doing something new and interesting within that category? And we looked at several that were that way. I think Gruntworks fits very easily in that category, not only for the pricing, but for the incremental technical things that were mentioned as well.
Sure. Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see. They certainly are moving that category along, and that's interesting. Another new category, and one of the things that I think is interesting here is this second one is also a SaaS offering. It's software as a service, you know, completely web-based and delivered. And this is the workflow information, that automation software from XCM. They've been, you know, kind of building this. They are the category because there's really no one else doing this standalone. And I think it's kind of interesting. And I was interested in the fact that that it was like Gruntworks, a SaaS offering. Did that make any difference to you, Dave?
No, I don't think it did, because I look at this as very much a different category. I look particularly, you know, at the workflow portion of it, the ability to balance the workloads, for example, which I think is enormously useful, and effective use of web resources as well. You know, having people with their own home pages and being able to access that home page and assign through the web and actually manage much of the workflow that way. So even though it's a very closely related product line, I saw it as an entirely different category.
Well, you're right. It certainly is. It certainly is, and it's one that that's starting to get a lot of attention. And hopefully, the Innovation Awards will help more practitioners kind of perk up and say, you know, this is something that we have to go out and look at. Brent, you find people talking about workflow now that we're getting farther into the digital world?
Well, remember, we've only got half of the firms, approximately, that have even got a good paperless
sure.
process in place,
right.
And this is going to be for the more cutting edge firms that have already gone down that road and have got a good paperless process in place, and they're kind of moving to the next level, in my opinion.
Sure, sure. And Randy, I know you and I have talked about XCM. More than once, and you're kind of high on this idea.
I am, and you know, with full disclosure, I actually got to speak at their conference in mid-June, so I
sure.
actually got even some of the more updated information from them. They continue to push the features inside their product for key things that are needed, like due date monitoring and scheduling at this point. And I actually talked to four different practitioners, sole practitioners, using the product inside their office to manage the workflow. And I usually picture this as being a multi-site or, you know, a complex practice type of management tool. But as I listened to these firms that were quite small using the product, I was actually quite pleased to see what they were doing. Further, you know, this whole issue of software as a service and the updates that are slipstreamed into the product are pretty effective. Liked the new integration into CCH's practice, so the data was automatically populated. And of course, a lot of people are finding XCM because it's being promoted by the CCH field team at this point.
Right.
But you know, since the product was really developed by a CPA firm and practitioners, they're being pretty practical about what it takes to get the job done right, not a lot of overhead, and they continue to tell stories in their own firm and in other firms where it's been implemented of attracting new people, working less hours during tax season, and responding to clients better with accurate information.
Yeah, they really do, and that it's interesting that you mentioned the CCH thing, because that is both a blessing and a curse, I believe. I've talked to many firms that have looked at XCM, or they thought they looked at XCM, and they said, "Oh, that's really great, but we don't use CCH practice," and simply walk away, and because of that integration, with not understanding that the integration is something added on the top. XCM is standalone, can be used with anything. In fact, there are firms who are using it who aren't even paperless. You have to kind of imagine how that works, but you certainly do not have to be a CCH user to utilize XCM, and I think there's some confusion around that.
In fact, that is actually a superb point, because I frequently will recommend XCM before people go paperless if they're very specifically having workflow problems. And with the new feature inside the product added this year, being able to do Windows Explorer, do-it-yourself paperless, for people that are well organized, you can now point to documents on your server and get most of the benefits for small firms of having a paperless-like system that's actually managed and monitored by XCM without the documents flowing through email.
Sure. Well, great segue. We're talking about email. We're talking about CCH, and CCH, won yet another innovation award this year for the ProSystem FX Document Email Management System, and this is something that I think is pretty magic, that an awful lot of firms haven't even figured out that they have a huge problem with email management. Brent, did you get a chance to look at this in any depth, or what are your thoughts on this email management thing?
You know, I have not looked at this in any depth. I am not sure what they're doing with email management. I think most firms feel like they're managing their email through their Outlook folder system, and obviously that's not the best way to go.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's exactly not the right way to do it. But I like you. I don't think that people really understand that. What's the benefit of this, Randy, in your opinion?
Well, there's only a few systems that are actually doing this well right now, and clearly the benefit is being able to take an email that's been received by a single person and put it under appropriate records retention policy and share it among the entire firm in the document management system, applying the securities that are available there. In the past 90 days, I've actually spoken to a number of firms who no longer retain any exchange or email information, and that is so foreign to those who are still allowing all email to be kept for a number of years because they go back and look at their email. Most of the firms that I'm talking to now are not allowing email to be kept for any more than 3 or 4 weeks, and then it's all deleted because the email messages are winding up in the document management system. This particular particular feature in Document actually allows an email inside Outlook to be identified, classified, and stored appropriately inside CCH Document. And those features are, I think, important regardless of your size firm. And the implementation by CCH in this particular case is quite well done and certainly deserved recognition.
Sure. Now, Dave, the this whole idea of email management, whether it's done, you know, locally, or I'm going to say in firm, you know, via an Exchange server, or even with you know, with people who are using you know, ISP-based email. There's an awful lot of sole practitioners who do that, and you know, they might not be a candidate for this, for an email management system, but they certainly have problems to solve. Do you see solutions, other solutions, kind of like in this category coming?
I think there have to be for a couple of reasons, Greg, and you know, I'll sort of agree with what Randy had to say about it. I'm looking at firms that are simply overwhelmed by email management overall, and so they've adopted a blanket policy of simply deleting them without understanding the horrible risk involved in that and growing requirements, Sarbanes-Oxley and other compliance issues. So I think every firm at some point is going to have to come to terms with an effective email management system. I think hats off to CCH for doing a lot of trailblazing here. It's a very good product in what it allows to do. And all I can say for smaller CPAs who are using ISP-based email, eventually they're going to have to, I think, match that with a system like this or an Outlook-based system so that they have some records retention of email. It's going to become mandatory, I believe.
Sure. Sure. Once the profession figures out what the e-discovery rules are, and we all start going, oh my golly, we have a real problem here, and we have to figure out how we're going to solve it. So that covers the first three. The last two actually both went to Thomson Reuters, to different business units and completely separate products. And the interesting thing is that the products were submitted individually, they were voted upon individually, and they're both great products, but they actually work together beautifully. And that makes the last two, I think, even more interesting, although the fact that they work together really didn't have anything to do with the fact that they both won. The first one was the Engagement CS product, and that's, you know, that's certainly come a long ways, and it's wonderful for the profession that we now have. You know, for years we had Caseware, and that was it. And then along comes the ProFX system, you know, the Dave Wiles' old product that, you know, that kind of got grown up now as ProSystem FX Engagement, and Thomson comes up with Engagement CS, and between the two of them, we've got a real bidding war going here, as one moves ahead a couple of rungs, the other one catches up and moves ahead beyond that. And this is a year when Engagement CS took a big leap, and they did a lot of things. The other product was PPC's Smart E-Practice Aids, and if you live in an accounting firm like I do, the initials RBA and risk-based assessment just send shudders through everybody in the whole firm trying to figure out how they're going to do that, and evidently PPC has done a quite a decent job here with this with their smart practice aids, the risk assessment thing, and the sum of both of those working together is pretty powerful, and the judges were pretty high on those. Dave, you kind of live outside of public accounting and over in general technology land, but I know you have a deep and abiding interest in this stuff. Did you have some thoughts on those two products?
Yeah, certainly. And increasingly, you know, as I travel down whatever path my life takes, I'm also getting pulled deeply into the nonprofit world, as you know, particularly from the accounting and compliance side for nonprofits. So I'm looking at it perhaps not as with as many clients as Brett and Randy, but certainly in depth as many of the nonprofits struggle to go through the technology path. And that's where I tend to look at these products, and I'll look, you know, primarily at Engagement CS because, again, I'm so high on, first of all, the whole CS line, which I've followed for many years. I think it's a well-designed, very effective and very innovative product line. In this case, they've gone paperless with the engagement process, which I think is a marvelous step forward. As you know, anytime I see a really effective use of the Internet, I tend to be high on that product, and Engagement CS certainly falls within that. In terms of the other, looking at the practice aids, you know, the audit risk assessment piece is an awfully enormous piece, but it builds also on the previous work they've done on basic audits and audit standards. So I see this, again, as an incremental innovation in their e-practice aids line. So, again, kudos to both. I think they're great programs.
Right. Any other thoughts on that, on those two products?
Well, I think that I was just going to say I think that their decision to not only integrate the PPC stuff, since it was one of their assets anyway, was brilliant because a lot of practitioners have relied on PPC's practice aids for so long that's a huge part of the decision on which engagement software to select.
Yep.
And the other piece that, you know, I guess I'll just note, and you really were all over the risk-based assessments. In fact, I've been in two CPA firms this week, and in both cases, the discussion around risk-based assessment, what was going on, was exceptionally important, and both firms had picked the eTools product to help them with that particular issue and then integrated it into their engagement managers. So that whole issue is going to be a lot more, or those related issues are going to be more important over the next 3 to 5 years as the audit standards change so much. On the other side, the Engagement CS product has really matured to a level that at this point, particularly for the smaller practitioners and the integration points that you talk about, it's become a very elegant product to use. And I've actually seen two implementations this year that were particularly elegant in the way they were using Engagement CS. So the tool's got enough maturity now and enough strength that it certainly has come to the forefront now, and from my vantage point, a good reason to be on the list this year.
Well, it was it's an interesting exercise to go through, and I appreciate your time and your effort and your expertise and your voting, and I think those are five great products, and congratulations to all of those vendors for their innovation. So during this last weekend, Apple had a little bit of a meltdown, and they sold 1 million 3G phones, and everybody tried to activate them at the same time. I was trying to update my iTouch, and that wouldn't work worth a darn. It's pretty amazing. We've been talking about this for a while. Dave, is RIM dead?
No, I don't think BlackBerry's dead, just because it's so well entrenched in the corporate environment. It still tends to be the product of choice because it's lower cost. And I have to be honest with you, with most of the smartphones coming out now, the useful lifespan appears to be a year or less. I mean, the iPhone is great, but it's been out about a year, and already we've gone through a major upgrade to it that requires a whole new phone. So I think a lot of corporate departments and a lot of large accounting firms are going to look at these smartphones and say it's simply too expensive to try to keep up with the technology.
But in all fairness, Dave, it really doesn't require a new phone. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the old phone.
And in fact, in fact, Apple did issue an upgrade to the old iPhone that brings in many, many of the features of the new phone as well, except for the 3G part.
Exactly. And the navigation part.
And the navigation.
Well, the navigation that works. Now, who has iTouch or iPhone? I mean, I have an iTouch.
I have an iTouch.
Okay.
But I'm shopping for one. In fact, I'm going over to an AT&T demonstration and conference on the iPhone that they're throwing here in Washington week after next, just to look at where they're going with the whole line.
I'll tell you what, if I lived in a place that had AT&T service, I would own a 3G iPhone today. The ability to put applications on my iTouch is thoroughly amazing. It's incredible what these little applications do. They're a computer in your hand. Brent, what have you put on your iTouch?
I put Pandora on right away. It's one of the top 25 free ones, and there's some things about the iTouch or the iPhone that are still not there 100%, but in my opinion, the Exchange piece was huge, and we actually tested it with Exchange 2007 to see if it registered properly and if we had the ability to remotely wipe the device.
Right.
Which is kind of the main thing on corporate IT minds in terms of losing these devices, and it performed beautifully.
Wonderful. I'm looking. I downloaded I got the New York Times. And it's free. I mean, I could go over to the Kindle, but I have to pay for it. And so I get the New York Times. It's automatically pulled down. That's a pretty incredible kind of thing. I'm pretty impressed with this thing.
One comment is on battery life. You know, with the push email, it drains the battery quite a bit quicker.
Yeah, I have certainly noticed that we do have a little bit of a problem with that because my iTouch, unless I go in and shut off the wireless, it continues to want to go out and check even when it's off, and that's not a very good plan. But pretty interesting that they managed to sell a million of them in 3 days.
Yep,
that is interesting. And
that's a lot.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that's a lot of phones.
It's a lot of phones, and I'm sitting here looking at I track the cell phone industry very closely, and AT&T is starting to look like a runaway winner, not only with the iPhone, but the extensive 3G network that they built, the largest in the nation, arguably the fastest. That's what they're claiming anyway. And I'm sitting here looking at Verizon and Sprint as the two main competitors, and they're solidly in the also-ran category, even with, Sprint has just debuted the new Samsung Instinct.
Right.
Which looks and feels very much like an iPhone,
except,
again, the battery life is about half of what the iPhone's is.
Sure.
And it simply doesn't have the flexibility. AT&T's got a solid winner here, and they could well use it to catapult themselves to the top of the list.
Interesting stuff. Randy, you're holding on to your trio, right?
So far, I have been waiting for the next big thing, and I think the iPhone has done a marvelous job. I have actually recommended to a number of people using that. In fact, over dinner last night, was talking to someone who had updated and gotten one of those new phones and the sellout, and was very, very pleased with it. So I actually continue to hold out in hopes that we'll see much more of the Google phone technology, and that's actually the path I want to head down.
Sure. Well, these little applications are pretty impressive, and it kind of reminds me of what was going back and what was going on early in the early 80s when we first had the PC and the idea of having all those applications out there was I want to go open a computer land store, start selling software or something.
Yeah, I understand.
Interesting stuff. So, Brent, over in your part of the country, I see Microsoft is still trying to buy Yahoo, and they've got Icons, their best friend now, and they got all of that going on. But they seem to have forgotten completely about office accounting. What do you hear?
Well, there's no question that that Icon, who holds 5% of Yahoo, and stands to pick up almost half, well, a third to a half in terms of stock price on the sale to Microsoft. You know, it's easy to see why he's interested in that whole thing.
Sure.
And Yahoo's talking to Time Warner as well, you know, and so it's almost like, you know, we're shopping this thing. But Microsoft is really concerned about their market share on the online services, and, you know, they've advertised this S plus S software plus services thing. In fact, we're going up to an airlift here in a couple of weeks up in Seattle to hear what they have to say about that. But, you know, they're still losing money. They're still about 10% share while Google is still moving up. I think they had a 9% gain in, over the last quarter in their just in their search sites alone. And Microsoft sees this as a real problem. You know, they've always been the company that's provided the product and the shrink wrap. And as the world's moving more to a different model, you know, lease your software, so to speak, as opposed to buying it, you know, that's going to be a completely complete change in the thinking in Redmond. And they saw Yahoo as a way to get there fairly quickly. And if they don't do Yahoo, they may have to do it some other way.
Sure, sure.
I was just going to say, as far as office accounting goes, you know, this is a product which, you know, they are improving. There's a 2008 version. There wasn't much improvement in it. I think they added a few features and support for the Spanish language. But, you know, they don't see this as something that's going to make or break the company. They've always had a real hard time selling accounting software, and in this case, they're giving one of the versions away. So it's just not as high on the priority list as the online services stuff.
Well, I mean, they made such a big effort initially, and it seems like they've just kind of lost interest or something, that they're certainly not making the push now. The people in the Dynamics world, the grown up world, you know, they're certainly out there, and they're strong, and they've got a message, but the just the office accounting world, they just don't seem to be talking like they were before. And I can't figure out why a company as large as Microsoft, I mean, they ought to be able to do more than one thing at a time.
Well, here again, you got to pick your battles, right? And they've got several going on right now, and this accounting software battle versus Intuit's QuickBooks product is just not as high on the priority list. They're taking on VMware in the virtualization space. They've got this software plus services online thing going, and the whole Windows Server 2008 launch and everything that goes along with that. And you just have to pick priorities. You've got limited resources, even Microsoft has.
Yeah, when you look at you know, the equipped offering for that software or software plus services, using their phrase, that's a pretty big announcement from Microsoft's perspective. And I think, Brent, you're dead on this. You know, how many battles can you fight? I can tell you from what I know from John Toonbi, who actually manages that product line now, has been put back in charge of the effort. The development in the product for this year is very notable. And, in fact, they're having good success with their authorization in the U.K. because they were approved by the Chartered Accountants of the U.K. They're having good luck in their French rollout. So I think what you might see actually right now is their major attention has been turned to internationalizing the product, and then they'll turn back to the U.S. feature set and the marketing here. And I think in that swing, we'll pick up Canada and some other countries as they go. So all of a sudden, we'll have an international entry-level accounting product. You are right. The Dynamics people have their act together. They've been doing a lot of very innovative things. they think that they, and they are, competing pretty successfully against Intuit with the QuickBooks Enterprise versus some of the entry-level Dynamics pieces that they're doing. And based on Intuit's numbers, something's going on from that perspective. So, yeah, we're not hearing as much about it, but I think there's a whole lot that we don't see because we're being a little U.S.-centric on the office accounting piece.
Sure, that's, I suspect you're right.
And I got to tell you, the passion on the on John and his team that I've seen, because, I ask them a similar type of question, why are you being so quiet? And they said, well, look at all the things we're doing. And it's like, yeah, I guess you're right. I just hadn't been following that myself.
Yeah.
And then as they laid out where they were going, I said, okay, I get it. I see why you're doing what you're doing. And it makes good sense in terms of just timings and feature sets. So come fall, you'll see another round that will be worth watching.
Sure. Okay. So let me move on to another topic, and Randy, I'm gonna ask you for your opinion on this. This is one that's fairly close to your heart. I just filled out my CPE report the other day, forwarded up my calendar for all of the stuff that I had done last year. June 30th is the reporting period for. Not all the states, but an awful lot of the states. We've had this process, the NASBA organized CPE delivered by state societies and things like that. The hours haven't necessarily changed over the years. The body of knowledge gets larger. What are your thoughts, Randy, on this whole CPE thing? Is it good for the profession, or is it some of the other professions handle it very, very differently? What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, of course, for the listeners, I want to make sure they understand the bias, because I am one of the shareholders in K2, and we produce about 800 seminars or events to about 40,000 CPAs face-to-face every year.
Sure.
So there's obviously a business model for us on that. But we actually superbly value training and, more importantly, education, which is part of the reason I've got such a large commitment to what I do with that group and in general for seminars. The CPAs in general, I think, when they pick their CPE, most are being very cognizant about what they're choosing to try to improve their professional skills. I actually don't see that as much in CLE for lawyers or CEUs for bankers and so forth, at least not near the dedication. There's many CPAs when we're teaching live won't let us in a minute early, and of course we don't want to either. But, in other environments, we watch people that are just kind of reading papers or just not paying attention. The interesting facts that I've been watching this year as they've unfolded, one is the more profitable firms actually require more than 40 hours of CPE.
Right.
Many, many CPA firms are spending 80 and 85 hours, double the requirement, trying to get specific skill sets up inside their people, and I think that's actually marvelous, and it's dropping to the bottom line, which is also pretty important from a partner income. We do believe in the state society model, and our K2 organization supports that wholeheartedly. In many, many cases, our listeners here have their relationships with their state CPA societies, and they can actually ask their membership organization to schedule things that help them, and the state societies do an awful lot of work to try to get the right courses offered in the right time frame.
And I can tell you that anybody that would call a state society and ask for a certain course, the state society is thrilled to get that input, because they work really hard across the board at trying to deliver stuff that people want.
Yeah, if they get a member request in, they'll go to extraordinary lengths to satisfy just a single request. And in fact, I handled one earlier today where a member had approached a state society, who'd approached my Hammond office, who'd contacted me to say, hey, this state would like this type of course, this type of time frame. Is this doable? What's the story? So we see that very, very frequently. There's going to be other polls here, and of course you and I, Greg, have been producing some of those, some of the online offerings and so forth, but
right.
I also do believe in the face-to-face interaction. There's things that happen in that that case. Now, as far as CPE being good, if practitioners are choosing marginal or irrelevant CPE, or they're attending stuff that's done by bad presenters, that's really awful. That's a really long day.
And if they're doing it just to get the hours, and do you see that much? I don't.
You know, in our courses, no. I would say almost never do I see such a thing. So, you know, in that particular perspective, I just don't see that bored, you know, type of attendee. So, you know, there are some of those out there, but I think that's more the rare bird. So, now, could more CPE help? Yeah, but would I want it regulated? Probably not. I really think it helps maintain our skill sets and improve our skill sets, and there's so much going on with audit regulations, tax complexities, new technologies. I just can't imagine that 40 hours is enough, and when I look at how many hours I produce or sit in every year, I'm probably one of the luckiest guys in the world simply because I get to see so much and have to prepare and deliver so much.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting stuff. So, Dave, you spend a lot of time at conferences and things, both on the professional side and the industry side. There's a real hunger for learning, I think, among high achievers. Are you around other groups that mandate and regulate and legislate a certain amount of professional education?
You know, there aren't very many professions that do so to the same level that accounting and law do. But I'll tell you what really strikes me. I absolutely agree that the highly motivated people are highly motivated, and they're there to learn. And I think any time that you begin to tie this to the bottom line, that people get it. They understand that more education means more dollars in their pocket. I was just sitting here thinking there's a real dearth, it seems to me, of research on that specific question. And maybe we ought to try to figure out a way to run a little research project that somehow calculates the profitability of firms against the average number of CPE hours for their professionals. I think that'd be very interesting.
I would like to know it's factual. I know what's happening from some firms financially, but, you know, there's a lot of variables in there. But it's a very, very consistent situation where more education equals more profits.
I'm wondering if we could quantify that somehow. It'd be a tremendous...
Excuse me.
It might well be something that we consider adding to our productivity survey, so at least we can start capturing some data. Brent, you probably get 40 hours in by about the 1st of August, knowing the amount of training you do. What are your thoughts?
More like March, depending on the year. You're talking to a guy that's looking to recertify for the fourth time in 10 years. You know, it's just the nature of the beast. But I got to tell you, there are some. This is a major profit center for most state societies. I chaired our CPE committee years back, and we always surveyed the members to determine what they wanted. But without CPE, a lot of the state societies would lay off a third to a half of their staff, literally. And you know, would practitioners, if it wasn't mandated, go out and get training? Hard to say. I think the good ones would, obviously. Because it's the good ones that feel like they have to stay up to serve their clients well. On the other hand, there's a whole bunch that wouldn't, and they would slide by, and that's why we have the mandatory CPE.
Sure, and that's kind of the idea behind the regulation of the profession anyway, that you don't have to regulate the high end and the good performers and the responsible people. You have regulation to keep out to deal with the people who don't want to do that.
Yeah, and the good ones tend to suffer a little bit with that. And the example that I want to use is this mandatory ethics stuff, you know, that a lot of the states have. I watched a hotel room just filled, maybe 200 people here with individuals that, you know, because of the mandated ethics were sitting there, and you talk about reading the paper, that it was clear that they didn't want to be there.
Right.
So whether it's good to mandate certain topics or not,
right.
I'm not sure about that.
Exactly. I remember as soon as you said that, I flashed back on my auditing professor back in undergraduate work, who said who described ethics and said, if you know what ethics is, I don't have to teach it to you, and if you don't know what it is, I can't teach it to you.
That's exactly right.
Which I thought was kind of interesting. I want to spend just a couple of minutes with a topic that I've actually gotten from a couple of listeners or readers over the last couple of months, and this involves how do they go about vetting how do they meet the reasonable and prudent man standard, or is that the right standard, when they start talking about SaaS applications. The particular case, a listener called me and said, I'm thinking about outsourcing my Exchange server. I've heard you guys talking about that, and I'd like to outsource my Exchange server, but how do I know that I can trust these guys with sensitive client information? And I counseled him and said, well, if you have sensitive client information in your email, you have a whole other problem. But setting that problem aside, What kind of ideas and testing and what's your thought process when you go about looking at a SaaS application? Brent, what do you do? Just you got a SaaS 70, I'm happy, or what?
Well, I think you have to look at software as a service like you would look at any other piece of your business. You know, I mean, if you're going to put your office in a certain location, there's a certain amount of research that you're going to do about that location, about the buildings around it and the landlords, and you're going to check the county out and a few other things. You know, when you hire a staff person, you know, you do background checks, you look at resumes, you call previous employers. You know, these are just things that we do when we enter into a business relationship, and I don't think software as a service is really any different. The reality is we all have some sensitive information in our email, and the reality is that we have sensitive information on other devices that we use, like laptop computers, and we don't think about how risky it is when those things are out and about.
So the kinds of things that you described, I think people are comfortable with because they know how to do that. They know how to, if you're gonna rent a new office building, you know how to drive down the street and see who your neighbors are and things. But I think the question is here, they don't know how to do that digitally or electronically, and they're looking to us to say, well, okay, I understand that, but you know, what kinds of things should I be doing?
Well, so if someone's going to host your Exchange server, for example, I think the prudent questions are, tell me about your data center. You know, tell me about the security of your data center and the backup and your disaster plan. And what happens if I choose to leave? Can you guarantee that all of my data is going to leave with me? You know, are you going to give that to me in writing? Those are the kinds of things I'm talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, I usually go after redundancy too. Those were a great list, Brent. You know, are you running multiple sites? In many cases, I encourage clients to look at outside the U.S. border hosting, simply because you've got different legal regulations for discovery purposes, which is actually handy at times. I also, when I look at the contracts on that, I also ask for financials. So I want to know the financial stability of the company as much as I can. So, you know, what they'll disclose on that side is very helpful. And then I'm clearly checking references with other clients as much as they'll disclose that, recognizing we'll only get the happy ones, but I want to hear what the experience was like.
So is a SAS 70 certificate important to you, Randy?
It does help from a confidence perspective, but to me, that's only part of the battle. So
explain what that is for the listeners, will you?
Well, basically, it's certifications on security access and on procedures that ensure availability. And if such an audit has been done, I think we have greater assurance that operations are correct. However, you know, having gone behind a number of SAF 70 audits, there's still holes inside procedures and other items that bother me. So they don't, in my mind, assure complete protection. So it's not like, oh, it's there, it's a seal of approval, no worries. But it is a factor that the company has enough financial resources and they've thought that the need was great enough that they've spent the money to get that done and they've proactively looked at trying to make their operations more reliable and secure.
Right. I think most people would look at that and understand that they don't know what the SAS 70 means, but it is kind of a technological good housekeeping seal. Brent, is that a fair way?
Yeah, it's an independent third party that is warranting the procedures that you're looking for, that the procedures are in place.
Okay. So when I told this this particular listener that I was more concerned about the fact that he had sensitive client information in his email than I was with the proper vetting of a national hosting exchange hosting company. Was that approximately reasonable advice, do you think?
Well, I think so, but as a practical matter, I think you could go to any practitioner's mailbox store and find some sensitive stuff in there. It's just, it's one of those things that we all deal with in practice. You know, we have clients that email information to us that could be considered sensitive.
Yeah, that's just on the receive side. There's not much you can do about that. So.
That's right.
Interesting. Okay, we're starting to get towards the end of our time, Brent. And I want to make sure we have time for you to talk a little bit about the Server 08 topic of the month. What do you want to share with us this month?
Well, I've been working with a couple of Windows Server 08 technologies over the last little while. The one that's top of the mind, and I just want to briefly mention that Hyper-V code is now gold. You can download it, and if you've been using a previous version of Hyper-V for virtualization testing, it is now released, and that's available. The other one, I just wanted to say that briefly, but the other one I wanted to mention today as far as the topic of the month is Windows Deployment Services. We all have this situation where we replace our machines, and you know, after 3 years in our firm, we found that we needed to replace about a dozen desktop machines. And of course, the time that it takes to load up the base operating system can be significant. And the real time is loading up all of the applications, the accounting and the tax applications, and the document management the links to online research and all of those things that make up a desktop installation. And so what we did this time is we created a Windows deployment image using Windows Server 2008, and it took, you know, about 3 to 4 hours to get that image just the way we wanted it with all of our applications, all of our accounting and tax applications. We used that image and created Vista, as you know, is non-HAL. It doesn't require the HAL to be the same on the cloned machine, if you will. And so we used that machine that we built as a base to create an image, and we put that image on a Windows Deployment Server, and then we rolled out the other 11 machines, and we found that it took about 45 minutes to have that machine with absolutely no operating system on connect Windows deployment server using a Pixie boot, and to pull that image down, and the image had all of the applications that we put on the base image, and it took about 45 minutes to do that. So we were impressed with the way the whole process worked, and better than RIS, which was the previous deployment technology in Windows Server. With the WIM image, if we find that one of our applications gets updated or changes, then we can actually open that image and we can put the new application inside that image, so that when we use it to do it, the next machine will have the latest information inside of the image. We could not do that before.
Super. Interesting stuff. Next time, Dave, next time you buy a dozen machines, you'll know exactly how to handle it, right?
Exactly right.
Super. It's a great way to go. Well, guys, we're almost completely out of time. I want to cover just a couple of things. We are going to record Tech2Go episode 20, our August 2008 episode. We'll record live on August 14th. That's Thursday, August 14th at 10 a.m. Central. And so that's our time. If you'd like to join us, we'd love to have you. And we will have our guest on that particular show, and we'll make sure that we get him. I don't want to spill the beans yet. I want to make sure that we've got everything lined up. But I'm excited about this guest. So I'm looking forward to August 14th at 10 a.m. So. Guys, thanks so much for your time. Randy Johnson of K2 fame and NMGI and all the rest of the things that you do, thanks for your time today, and we appreciate talking to you. David, thank you so very much for sharing your time with us again today, and keep up all the good work you're doing. And someday we're going to talk about network neutrality, because I know you've got some passion in there, and we can figure out what that means to the accounting profession. How's that?
I'll look forward to it.
Wonderful. And Mr. Goodfellow, the man with more initials after his name than before, recertified 3 times in 10 years. Is that right?
Yeah, the fourth one's coming up in the fall here.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know, when you're as smart as you are, that's not real hard, though, right?
It's hard.
Thanks. Thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it. This is episode 19 of Tech2Go, Intersection Live, the CPA Technology Advisor. Thank you. This has been Tech2Go, episode 19, Innovation.
For more information about the CPA Technology Advisor's other podcast programs, webcasts, and our e-newsletter, visit www.cpatechadvisor.com. To ask questions or leave comments about our podcasts, call 800-456-0864, extension 2106, or tune into future episodes where you're able to ask questions live via TalkShoe.com.